Shall we begin with our second week on mourning and our second theorization of mourning and melancholia? No problems about getting hold of the text, yes? Yep, good, okay. Now, there is, I think the identifications that and distinctions that Abraham and Tarok introduce are very suggestive and very valuable, but there are also, I think, confusions with the terminology, and that's partly why I sent you the extracts from La Planche and Pontalis, from the dictionary, just to try and establish a certain clarity about what some of the basic terms meant, because they are taking over the terms giving, in the case of the notion of incorporation, giving a very interesting development. But on the notion of introjection, I think there's real conceptual muddle and confusion in what they're saying. I'm just hoping to sort of introduce some clarity about it, as it were, because they're using the notion of introjection in a radically different way from the way in which Freud uses it or the way in which it is standardly used within psychoanalytic discourse. And they're picking up on the chap who introduced it, who was one of Freud's first followers, Sandor Ferenczi, a Hungarian psychoanalyst. And both Abraham and Tarok are Hungarians who settled in France. I think they fled the Nazis, because they were both Jewish. There had been a big psychoanalytic culture in Budapest before the war, and there was a distinct Hungarian school with a lot of quite interesting thinkers. I think I'm right in saying that Tarok and Abraham trained with Ferenczi, and he may even have been their analyst. That was often the case. And so there's a kind of loyalty to Ferenczi, which you can sort of understand because he invented this word introjection, okay? But I think the confusions around the term actually go back to the man who invented it, so to speak. There had been a kind of clarification of the term, and I think La Planche and Pontalis give us that clarification in their dictionary. But out of loyalty to him, Tarok, and then in the early essay, and then later the two of them together, the husband and wife team, want to somehow or other keep Ferenczi's term in the way in which Ferenczi seems to use the term, because they think that the meaning he gives to it is in danger of being lost, and it's an important meaning. I'm going to go through and give you, as it were, what more or less would be an agreed consensus around this family of terms, all of which seem similar to each other: incorporation, introjection, internalization, identification. They're all related to a sort of family of related concepts, as it were. I think it's important to try and establish some distinctions between them. Now, the term to start with, in a way, is the term incorporation, because that's the originary moment, as it were. It's the most primitive psychical process in the infant, a taking in through the mouth, okay, and it obviously relates to that absolutely basic moment of feeding on which life is absolutely dependent from the very first moments of life outside the womb. But that, and that experience is seen as setting up a prototype for later mental processes. Okay, so that I'll just read out Laplanche and Pontalisi's little initial head definition of incorporation. Process was what whereby the subject, more or less on the level of fantasy, has an object penetrate his body and keeps it inside his body. Incorporation constitutes an instinctual aim and a mode of object relationship, a way of relating to other objects through the mouth, through taking in through the mouth, which are characteristic of the oral stage. Although it has a special relationship with the mouth and with the ingestion of food, it may also be lived out in relation with other erotogenic zones and other functions. That is to say, you can have incorporation at other sites of the body and through other orifices of the body. Incorporation provides the corporal, the bodily model, for later mental processes, introjection and identification. Provides a model, they say. Okay. And in particular, they, in their conceptual analysis of the way of the term and the way it's standardly used, incorporation contains three meanings. First meaning, it means to obtain pleasure by making an object penetrate oneself. To obtain pleasure by making an object penetrate oneself. Secondly, it means to destroy the object in incorporating it, in taking it in. And thirdly, it means keeping the object within oneself in order to appropriate the object's qualities. In order to appropriate the object's qualities. And they comment, it's this last aspect that makes incorporation into the matrix of interjection and identification. The idea that in incorporating in the object and in, you know, if you like, ingesting it, swallowing it, metabolizing it, to use Laplanche's term, you take on board its qualities. Okay, so it's like a kind of very primitive form of psychical cannibalism, as it were. And though it's proper to the oral stage, it describes a mode of relationship that can be also performed in relationship to other bodily functions. Incorporation can take place, they say, via the skin, via respiration, via sight, via hearing. And indeed, there is an anal incorporation insofar as the rectal cavity is identified with the mouth, and a genital incorporation that is most strikingly manifest in the fantasy of retention of the penis within the body. And furthermore, that the object of incorporation can be partial, part objects. Okay. So that's setting up a notion of a fundamental bodily experience, one fundamental to life, being a prototype for later psychological processes, and being a mode of relating to other objects than just food. Okay. But they stress very much that it's to incorporate is to take something and to put it inside the body, and it's the body and its boundaries that are crucial in incorporation. Okay. Now, in introjection, let's find out. Yes. It's around the notion of on the term introjection that I think there's potential confusion in the nevertheless extremely interesting arguments that Abraham and Tarek are making. And again, I'm going to read the head definition in bold print at the head of the article. Process whereby, so a process revealed by analytic investigation. In fantasy, the subject transposes objects and their inherent qualities from the outside to the inside of himself. Okay, transposes objects and their inherent qualities from the outside to the inside of himself. Introjection is close in meaning to incorporation, which indeed provides it with a bodily model. but he does not necessarily imply any reference to the body's real boundaries. Because you can, you talk about interjection into the ego, interjection into the ego ideal, interjection into the superego. So the site for interjection is not, in the first instance, either the body or a fantasy of the body, okay, but it's into the psychical agencies, it's the different psychical sites, if you like, in the topography of the psychical apparatus. It is closely akin to identification, they say. Now, I'm going to read a little bit from what they say, because they make what I think is a really crucial point. I don't know if there's... This is 67. So this is actually written before Abraham and Torok, or between Torok writes her piece on the exquisite corpse fantasy, which is 1968. So they don't know, though they're in Paris, they might have been aware of these kinds of arguments, but it's not published. So they say it was Ferenczi, Sandor Ferenczi, who coined the term introjection, and he sets up an initial opposition between introjection and projection. And that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? You know, you introject something into the mind or the different mental sites within the mental apparatus, or you project something from the inside out. And it comes. The word comes from the Latin, iacere, to throw out. So, intro, meaning you throw something on the inside, projection, you throw something before you, that is to say, outside you. And we get other words in English like that, don't we? Injection. And even words like subject and object, which have, you know, gone through so many different usages, began life in that kind of way as metaphorical terms. An object was something that was thrown in front of you, that was positioned in front of you. A subject is something that was positioned under something, and that's the original meaning of the notion of subject, somebody who is subjected to authority or power or control or whatever. And they quote from Ferenczi, whereas the paranoiac expels from his ego the impulses that have become unpleasant, the neurotic helps himself by taking into the ego as large a part as of the outside world, making it the object of unconscious fantasies. This is Ferenczi. And one might give to this process, in contrast to projection, the name introjection. Okay. So expelling something that's unpleasant into the outside, he doesn't actually say something that's pleasant, but he says taking into the ego as large as possible a part of the outside world, objects from the outside world, and making them the object of unconscious fantasy. And I'll just continue reading what that's a quote from Ferenczi. I'll continue reading what Laplanche and Pontalis say. In this article as a whole, however, they say, it is hard to discern a precise meaning of the concept of introjection, because Ferenczi seems to use the word in a broad sense to indicate what he calls, quote, a passion for transference, which leads to the neurotic to mollify, it's a quote from Ferenczi again, to mollify the free-floating affects, like anxiety, for instance, by extension of his circle of interest, unquote. He ends up using the word to designate a type of behavior, chiefly in hysterics, that might equally well be described, however, as projection, which is supposed to be its opposite. So this is where the original conceptual muddle, I think, occurs, the very point where Ferenczi introduces the term. He's wanting to set up an opposition between introjection and projection. He does talk about taking objects from the outside world into the self, into the ego, explicitly into the ego, okay. But he sees that process, and this gets really confusing, as an extension of the ego, as transference, where you transfer feelings you have onto a new object, as famously in the model of psychoanalytic treatment, where the patient, without knowing what they're doing, transfers onto the analyst or onto the analytic situation earlier situations and feelings and fantasies from the past, as it were. Now, seeing that as intro, and everybody, most people have that reaction, but that's not intro. You know, transference is you're taking something that's in your own conscious and you're projecting it onto the analyst. Now, he wants to describe that as taking the analyst into your ego in some way. So he sets up a real confusion of the direction of travel. Which way is this process going? Is it going from inside to out or from the outside to in? Now, he's chosen a word beginning with intro, okay, and he does use the formulation, taking it in, objects from the world into the ego. But then when he goes on to elaborate that, what he's talking about is the ego attaching its feelings to new objects. You know, like we saw in the narcissism paper, where the ego donates its narcissism and falls in love with new objects. Now, it's very hard to see that as being as travelling from the outside in, okay, rather than the ego taking things from its libidinal reservoirs, Freud calls it, and forming attachments to new objects. Now, of course, when you form an attachment to an object, you have a mental representation of that in your mind, okay? but the way he tends to use it, Frenzy that is he's describing something that looks more like a process that starts from in here and travels to out there, okay? But he's calling it introjection. So I think that's the original confusion around the term. Goes right back to the essay in which he sets up the opposition, Frenzy sets up the opposition between intro and projection, as it were. Now Freud, I think reuses the word and gives it a much more sensible definition or usage, okay, by keeping true to the original opposition between intro and projection. And they quote a couple of sentences from his article, from various articles of Freud's, particularly, I think, the one on negation. Freud talks about a purified pleasure ego that is constituted by an introjection of everything that is a source of pleasure into the ego, and by the projection outwards of whatever brings about unpleasure. So Freud sets up and keeps it to that inside-outside movement in one direction and in another direction, but he relates it to the pleasure principle, that what's taken in is what's pleasurable, and what's unpleasurable is expelled or projected outwards. Now, in a way, I suppose in defense of Ferenczi, you could say, and this is in a way what they're saying, I guess, i.e. Abraham and Tarek, that he's distinguishing between two types of mental process. I think he keeps using the notion of projection in the standard psychoanalytic sense, in which the ego projects out of itself stuff it doesn't want to recognize. Stuff that's disturbing, distressing, unpleasant, unpleasurable in some way, and as it were, attributes it to other people, as in classically in paranoia, right, where the aggressions and hostility of the ego are projected into someone else, who is then felt to be the persecutor, and so your projected feelings return to you from the outside. Okay, so this person hates me and is out to get me, or this person is trying to sort of sexually seduce me, where you're disowning your own sexual feelings for the other person. So in a sense, when you project the stuff out of you, it's kind of like an analogous to repression. You don't want to know about it, but instead of burying it in the unconscious, you are attributing it to somebody else. Whereas the odd way in which, indeed in some ways I think the illogical way in which he's using the term introjection, is to say this is a positive process. This enables the ego to multiply its objects, to form new attachments. Okay, but he still wants to see it as somehow or other, even though he describes it as something that expands the ego and leads the ego into a more varied world. And he calls it transference, he still wants to somehow hang on to the idea that it's taking something into the ego. And that's the confusion, as it were. about around the term. And I suppose you could defend it by saying, you know, well, projection is bound up with denial and disavowal of stuff that you really don't want to acknowledge and which is painful and distressing and shameful or whatever it may be, whereas the way he's using the word introjection is that this is positive. You are forming positive new connections with new objects. You keep saying it enriches the ego. Okay. So there is that confusion. I mean, just the word itself, whenever I read their essay, I always cross out the word introjection and write in extension, because it's a process of extension that's being talked about, rather than a taking into the self or into the ego. So there is that constant confusion about the very word itself. It's a bit like reading the Strachey translation of drive and having mentally to remind oneself that it's not an instinct in Freud, even though Strachey's calling the drive an instinct, translating as instinct. You always have to kind of remind yourself, as it were. And they say as well, incorporation they insist on that useful distinction between incorporation being something being taken within the body, the body image, within the body ego, or a fantasy of the body, whereas introjection is something being taken into the mental apparatus without necessarily any reference to bodily boundaries, etc. Okay. Both incorporation and introjection in their different ways in the standard Freudian or psychoanalytic usage deals with objects and part objects. Okay. Another word that's used and they distinguish from the others is internalization. Internalization is about taking something inside, but it's what's been taken inside is a relationship, not just an object. Okay, and the example they give is of the sort of conflict in I think they may even say it in the Oedipus situation between parent and child, let's say father and son, which is then internalized as an internal conflict between superego and ego. Okay, so the word internalize is used to describe the taking of relationships from the outside and replaying them inside the psyche as between different agencies in the psyche. Internalization. Okay, and indeed it's something like that we saw Freud describing last week in the Mourning and Melancholia essay, where he says the ambivalent relationship to the lost object is taken in and is played out as this sadomasochistic drama in which the superego beats up the ego for being contemptible, impotent, pathetic, unreliable, impoverished, whatever, as it were. Okay. Now that would be a notion of internalization, because what's been taken in is not just an object, but a very particular relationship with that object. And the two terms of the relationship are then assigned to different parts of the different psychical agencies in the mind, usually between ego and superego, or between ego and ego ideal, as it were. So that's the kind of distinction that they draw, and which would be roughly standard usage. Okay, and it certainly fits with the etymology of the word introjection. Okay. Now, nevertheless, having said that, I want to follow through some of the thoughts and arguments in the two essays, because they take up Freud's attempt to understand and conceptualize melancholia by relating it to mourning and seeing it as a form of a pathological, exaggerated and intensified form of mourning, which has a set of features that aren't normally present in ordinary mourning. Freud uses to characterize melancholia is that it involves intense ambivalence in relation to the lost object, and an internalizing of that ambivalent relationship within the psyche, such that all the hostile, critical, and even suicidal impulses of the melancholic subject are really being taken out on the lost object that has been taken into the ego. leads to the little epigram about suicide as a form of display, is unconscious murder. Now, I had raised a question about whether, about Freud's, the analogy between the work of mourning and the work of melancholia. Given all the things Freud says and the very vivid descriptions, clinical descriptions he gives of the symptomology of melancholia, can one still say that the work of melancholia is about achieving a final detachment from the object? Can one really say that? Freud does say that, though a lot of what he actually prescribes at a concrete level, I was suggesting, points in a different direction. That's certainly the almost teleological aim of mourning. At a certain point, you accept the loss of the lost object, and you reorganize your mental space and your psychical relations around that acknowledgement that you've lost the object for whatever reason, death, betrayal, whatever it might be. Okay. And I was trying to suggest that there are certain things that might make one think that the melancholiac is not about however indirect and however lengthy and postponed away, and nevertheless trying to achieve the same acknowledgement of loss and detachment as mourning, but in fact melancholia might be about trying to do the opposite. Okay. And there is this question of mania, this sudden, he talks about a feast, a release of libido and of psychical energy in certain phases of melancholia, where melancholia can suddenly give way apparently to its opposite, but then swing back again into what we call manic depressive disorders today. And Freud begins to describe that, but he offers it as a real puzzle. How do we understand this? Well, we can see it as a kind of triumph over triumph over the lost object, and a release of libido from that punitive sadomasochistic drama between the ego and the lost object. Now, Maria Turok begins her essay in this very interesting way, quoting this exchange of letters between Freud and Carl Abraham. And Abraham is wanting to say that he'd come across something as an observation. He wasn't too sure how general it might be, but it was coming up again and again, and had Professor Freud noticed this. And that is, in ordinary forms of mourning, there are certain experiences that some people I feel ashamed about and can't bear to talk about, and then they confess to at some point in their analysis that there'd been a release of libido in the immediate aftermath of the death of a loved person, and how shaming this was, and how they couldn't really quite bear to acknowledge it, but at a certain point it comes up in the analysis. And these are not mourning processes that display in any other way the characteristics of melancholia. So is this a kind of normal, inverted commas, mania that occurs frequently or often enough in the normal mourning process? And she wants to say Freud didn't really listen to Abraham, and he didn't kind of take it further, but I am taking it further. Okay. And she just quotes a few striking and touching bits from various analyses of this kind of increase of libido as part of the mourning process. My mother was there, dead, and at a time when people should feel the most intense grief and be doleful and forlorn, at a time when when the arms and legs should give way, when the whole frame should be prostrate, sinking to the floor, I can hardly bring myself to say it. At that very moment, I had sensations, yes, carnal sensations. Or again, another one saying, I've never understood how something like that could have happened to me. I've never forgiven myself, but a giddy song coursed through my mind and wouldn't leave me. It continued during the entire vigil by the body. I tried on the black veil like a bride preparing for the big day. Extraordinary metaphor. Okay, this is a woman speaking. I tried on the black bra, the black veil like a bride preparing for the big day. Or again, someone saying, somebody in a state of mourning saying, he pursued me intensely and I wanted to marry him, but an inner voice said to me, you would then have to abandon your dead. You would then have to abandon your dead. This sad and insistent voice would return, and for a long time I heeded its call. The world was an immense desert to me. And then I think her final little clinical snippet is, I've never forgiven myself for something. The day my father died, I had intercourse with my husband. It was the first time I actually felt desire and satisfaction with him shortly after we separated. Think about that wonderful set of non sequiturs, right? The father dies, she has her first real sexual experience with her husband, and then leaves him. Okay, now, what interesting logic that's suggested there about the husband as a inadequate substitute for the father, and then the guilt at that becoming sexually adequate and leaving the husband. And this leads her then to offer us a proposition. This illness of mourning does not result, as might appear, from the affliction caused by the object loss itself, but rather from the feeling of an irreparable crime. The crime of having been overcome with desire, of having been surprised by an overflow of libido at the least appropriate moment, when it would behoove us to be grieving and in despair. Okay. So she wants to see this experience of a kind of libidinal invasion at that point, as it were, equivalent to manic reactions in melancholia. Okay. She then goes into the whole genesis of the concept of interjection with Ferenczi, which I've already talked about. And she quotes a chunk of Ferenczi, and I think reading it through, you can see just the oddity of this choice of that word, supposedly in opposition to projection. Whereas the more you read about the description of the process, it doesn't feel like putting something inside, but as it were, multiplying one's relationships to the outside instead. But she takes up the term and develops it in her own way. She claims in Ferenczi's account there are three characteristics of interjection. One, it's an extension of autoerotic interests. Two, it is a broadening of the ego through the removal of repression. And three, the including of the object in the ego is thereby an extension to the external world of the ego's original autoerotic interests. Well, that very description seems to me it's going from the inside out, an extension to the external world of the ego's original autoerotic interests, right? This is an inside-out process, not an outside-in process, so this is that constant, But she says, and it's an enriching process, introjection, she wants to argue, and it's not simply the occasion by loss, as in Freud's account in Mourning and Melancholia, where the taking of the object into the ego is occasioned by the loss of the object and the ambivalence towards the object because of the loss. Okay. Generally through the two essays, there is a kind of celebration of introjection as a process by which the ego is built up and enriched in its relations to the outside world. And somehow or other, in a way that's never really explained, repression is overcome. Okay. But what's really interesting, I think, is what she does with the notion of incorporation and how she develops that. So I want to say a few things about that. Now, she says, but one of the things that distinguishes, and she wants to set up incorporation as opposed to introjection, okay, whereas in the standard Freudian or psychoanalytic usage, it's a bodily model for a process that is a more general mental process. But she wants to, in her understanding of the notion of incorporation, or of the process she wants to call incorporation, yes, it's to do with the body, or a fantasy of the body. This mechanism does suppose loss, the loss of an object, in order for it to come into action, for it to take effect. The loss acts as a prohibition, and whatever form it may take, it constitutes an insurmountable obstacle to introjection, an obstacle to forming new object relations. Okay. The prohibited object is settled in the ego in order to compensate for the lost pleasure and the failed introjection. So that's the move she's making, which she'll elaborate. Okay, there's something is prohibited, but nevertheless it's still taken into the inside, into the ego in particular, and it kind of makes up for a lost pleasure that's associated with the lost object. And she elaborates that further as it becomes a blockage, a point of blockage, she'll go on to say. But she says, incorporation takes time, like mourning. It takes time, it's a process you gradually work through. Whereas incorporation, she says, is invariably distinct from introjection because it is instantaneous and magical. Instantaneous and magical. It's like a form of magical thinking. The object of pleasure being absent, incorporation obeys the pleasure principle and functions through a series of hallucinatory fulfillments. So incorporation is born of a prohibition which it attempts to sidestep, okay, through developing a certain fantasy of the object that has been swallowed in a bodily way. The ultimate aim of incorporation is to recover in secret and through magic an object that for one reason or another is lost and is not performing its normal function. It's an illegal act. It must hide from view along with the desire that it masks. It must hide even from the ego. Secrecy is imperative to incorporation. Introjection takes place in the open through naming and through language, whereas incorporation is this secret, magical, as it were, incorporation of the object on the inside. Okay. So the incorporated object functions almost like it. She later develops the metaphor of like a tombstone, in a psychical tomb or tombstone. Something is buried here. Okay. Like a commemorative monument, the incorporated object betokens the place, the date, and the circumstances in which desires were banished. They stand like tombs in the life of the ego. Okay. Now she says it's modeled on, this is why she calls it incorporation, the bodily fantasy of feeding or ingestion, okay, of a taking in, of as it were, of food, and it's marked continually by that oral relationship in fantasy. A magical procedure in which eating, and she uses the same metaphor that Freud uses of the feast, the manic feast, in which eating, a fantasy of eating, is paraded as the equivalent of an immediate but purely hallucinatory and illusory introjection. It's as if you're forming a relationship with a new object, but actually you're not. It's archaic, it's primitive, it's a form of magical thinking. In which you can, and she goes on to say, which you deny that you've lost anything. Okay, it's a denial of loss rather than an acknowledgement of loss. And it is bound up with a relationship to another person. Okay, which was a relationship. A libidinal relationship, often a libidinal relationship that was secretive or forbidden or whatever. Okay. Right. She talks, and again, it's interesting, she talks about what's formed is an imago, an image, an image, a fantasy figure, as it were. In which the drives are congealed, the drives, the forbidden wishes or drives, are congealed into an imago. And the imago, along with its external embodiment in the object, is set up as a repository of hope. The desires it forbade would one day be realized. And that gives this incorporated object a kind of fixating power. Okay. Don't really want to pick out anything else. Yes, she says it's like a form of repression, and she says it's preservative repression, and that the ego represents often this incorporated object in which certain desires, forbidden desires, are kind of congealed and hidden, as an exquisite corpse lying somewhere inside itself. This fantasy of the exquisite corpse. The ego looks for this exquisite corpse and continually in the hope of one day reviving it. Those patients of mourning who choose psychoanalysis seem to know nothing of their attempts to recapture this precise moment. Everything unfolds as though a mysterious compass led them to the tomb wherein the repressed problem lies. And then she then quotes that poem that we read last week, though I think, I don't know, we only said one or two things about it. Poe's poem, Ulalume, the poem in which the speaker finds himself going into this strange landscape with his psyche, who could be his mind, but is figured as another female figure. And he keeps asking these loaded questions, what am I doing here, why am I in this strange place, etc. And then right at the end of the poem he realises that he's at the tomb of the lost Ulalume, and this is the very same day of last year in which she died, and without knowing it, he is revisiting this tomb and doesn't know why until the final moment. And she wants to take that as a kind of literary exemplification of what she's talking about. The burial within the psyche of a lost libidinal relationship that is nevertheless continued and preserved. Okay. And it's not acknowledged as loss because it's still there, it's preserved, as it were. She gives a quite interesting clinical example, the figure of Thomas, so I won't go into that. We can talk about that in class. But again, I would have liked her to give us a more detailed elaboration of this fantasy of the exquisite corpse, because I think it's kind of very extremely interesting idea. And it throws a hell of a lot of light on Keats's poem, I think, Isabella or the Pot of Basil, which is about this extreme form of melancholia, and about Isabella's construction of the exquisite corpse out of the murdered body of her lover. So a kind of necrophiliac fantasy, if you like. And so the notion of exquisite pain, the exquisite corpse, he says, the tomb where the desire lies buried, the pain being a kind of here lies, an inscription in which the name of the deceased long remains undecipherable. The pain of self-torture is an invitation to the analyst to proceed with an exhumation as well as an accusation against, she describes a kind of characteristic dream that melancholics of the type that she's talking about produce. The following example captures this type of sometimes recurrent dream. Quote, I am being accused. I committed a terrible crime. I ate someone, and then I buried them. I'm on the site of the crime with someone who is charged with disinterring and examining the remains. This person is accusing me. I don't know who it is I ate and buried. I only know that I myself committed the crime. For this reason, I have to spend the rest of my life in prison. So that's one melancholic dream, and she's saying that scenario turns up again and again. Of course, it's illogical. I ate somebody and then buried them. Now, at a literal level, that's nonsensical, but it describes the psychological process. Okay. And she more or less says the trap for the analyst here is to take up the role of judge and accuser, as it were, that they're being handed in the fantasy. Okay. A couple of years later, they return to the subject, develop both some of the clinical implications of it, but also achieve a bit more conceptual clarity as well. And they do this by developing the idea of fantasy a bit more. It's a more restrictive idea of fantasy. Fantasy, in their account, is always conservative, defensive, and the role of fantasy is to block something, to stop new psychological developments taking place, developments that would be necessary in the case of mourning, that would acknowledge loss, and would have to then rearrange, you know, the mental furniture, the mental internal mental relationships in relationship to the new mental landscape in which the loved person is no longer there. Whereas the fantasy, they say, is a preservation of the status quo. It is preventative, it's conservative. It's almost as if they're saying all fantasies are screen fantasies. Remember the notion of screen memory that Freud develops? The screen memory is always hiding something else. It's designed to do that, to block out something. And their notion of fantasy is like that, so that all fantasies have that defensive, conservative function to sort of indirectly represent something which they at the same time conceal and hide in order to keep things as they are, in order not to have to initiate a process of painful change, of acknowledgement of loss. Okay, so in a sense it's about not acknowledging loss. That's almost like its rationale, if you like. And in particular, they say the fantasy of incorporation, of taking something on the inside, of swallowing something and feasting on it and burying it on the inside. And they're much more explicit this time around. This magical cure by incorporation is a denial that anything has been lost. Okay, in order not to have to swallow a loss, we fantasize swallowing or having swallowed that which has been lost, as if it was some kind of thing or food. And they specify two procedures, a sort of demetaphorization in which what should be figurative or symbolic is taken literally, and what they call objectivation, by which they mean pretending that the suffering is not an injury to themselves, to the subject, but instead a loss sustained by the love object. It's the love object who suffers, not me. Okay, so the relationship is switched around, as it were, as they say later on, very often in analyses like this, when the patient speaks and says the word I, they're speaking from the place of the lost object. Okay, and that, as I said in the email I sent out, that in a way it's the development of that insight of Freud's in his dream theory and in his model of fantasy, where the dreamer is not necessarily to be found in the dream at the place where the I appears, okay? Or in the fantasist is not necessarily located in the fantasy at the point where you expect them. They're located somewhere else in the scene, in the fantasy scene. And this is a development of that, okay? That in versions, melancholy versions of that, of the relation to the lost object. And again, it was almost implied in Freud's account last week, a taking in of the object into oneself in such a way that the object virtually erases the ego. The ego becomes the bad object and is punished, as it were. It's a form of identification which more or less erases the ego. And so that when the ego speaks, they're speaking as someone else, and you don't know who it is they're speaking as. If you take it at face value, you'll be wrong. Okay. So when the melancholic analysand of this kind says "I," right, the "I" isn't them. Okay, it's some other figure who speaks through them through identification. So he says, the fantasy of incorporation, we ingest the love object that we miss. This means that we refuse to mourn, that we shun the consequences of mourning, even though our psyche is fully bereaved. Incorporation is the refusal to claim as our own that part of ourselves that we placed in the lost object. Incorporation is the refusal to acknowledge the full import of loss, a loss that, if recognized as such, would effectively transform us in a painful way. In fine, incorporation is the refusal to interject, and to use that word, loss. And I think that's right. I think that logic is hinted at subtextually in Freud's own essay that melancholia is about refusal of loss and a maintaining of a kind of hallucinatory relationship in fantasy to the lost object. And in their account, particularly if the relationships, the libidinal connections with the lost object are in some ways forbidden, guilty. Okay. I think, I was hoping to go on to Keats, but I do want to say something about a very interesting couple of sections in the second paper, Mourning or Melancholia. The two of them are counterposed to each other, where they move beyond the pathological to think about the acquisition of language. And I think that's a very rich couple of sections that's worth thinking about. And it's also the seed for the work on melancholia that we'll be looking at next week by Julia Christopher. So they're thinking about the processes by which the infant acquires objects and extends their relationship to objects, and the role of the mother and of language in that process, which Freud seems to call introjection or transferential love. Okay, now let me just track back. He says introjection in the frenzy sense appears under comparable circumstances soon after birth. Without going into detail, suffice it to say the initial stages of introjection emerge in infancy when the mouth's emptiness is experienced alongside the mother's simultaneous presence. So this is revisiting that whole account of the oral drive in Freud's infantile sexuality essay. The emptiness is first experienced in the form of cries and sobs, delayed fullness, then as a calling to the mother, ways of requesting her presence as language or as communication. Further experiences include filling the oral void by producing sound and by exploring the empty cavity with the tongue in response to sounds that are received from the outside, from the mother. Finally, the early satisfactions of the mouth, as yet filled with the maternal object, are partially and gradually replaced by the novel satisfactions of a mouth now empty of that original object, but filled with words, and with words pertaining to the subject, words about me, about my feelings, my needs, whatever. The transition from a mouth filled with the breast to a mouth filled with words occurs by virtue of the intervening experience of the empty mouth. So one kind of fullness, an experience of emptiness and loss, and then another kind of fullness. Okay. Learning to fill the emptiness of the mouth with words is the initial model for introjection in the Ferenczi sense, or object relatedness, if you like. However, without the constant assistance of a mother endowed with language, already endowed with language, interjection in this sense could not take place. They make a philosophical joke, as it were. Not unlike the permanence of Descartes' God, the mother's constancy is the guarantor of the meaning of words in Descartes' theory. He entertains the possibility that our sense perceptions are all delusory and some evil demon might be tricking us, and the world isn't at all how it appears to us in our sense apparatus. And he's answered the question of, well, how can we trust our sense perceptions? Well, God sustains the truthfulness of our perceptions, as Descartes, I've always felt, slightly feeble reply. So they say the mother plays this role, okay, in the literal sense. Her presence guarantors the meaning of words. She has given the words to the child in the first place. Once this guarantee has been acquired, and only then, can words replace the mother's presence and give rise to fresh introjections. The absence of objects and of the empty mouth are transformed into words. At last, even the experience related to words are converted into yet other words. So the wants of the original oral vacancy are remedied by being turned into verbal relationships with the speaking community at large. Introjecting a desire, a pain, a situation means channeling them through language into a communion of empty mouths. So it's moved, interestingly, into a kind of, if you're almost like into a social or public space, this communion of empty mouths of those who share in the same language. This is how the literal ingestion of foods becomes introjection when viewed figuratively. The passage from food to language in the mouth presupposes the successful replacement of the object's presence with the self's cognition of its absence, an acknowledgement of its absence, as it were. In the fantasy of incorporation, there's a substitution, they're going to say, of one kind of mouth work, by analogy with the dream work or the joke work. They talk about the mouth work. Because our mouth is unable to say certain words and unable to formulate certain sentences, we fantasize, for reasons yet to be determined, that we're actually taking into our mouth the unnamed object itself. This is in Melancholia. What can't be spoken, what can't be voiced, right, is then reduced from words in the mouth to a fantasy object in the mouth that's been swallowed. Indeed, it's a representation of the beloved person that is swallowed and incorporated when words fail to fill the subject's void. Hence, an imaginary thing is inserted into their place in the mouth. The desperate ploy of filling the mouth with illusory nourishment has the equally illusory effect of eradicating the idea that there is a void to be filled with words. We may conclude that in the face of both the urgency and impossibility of performing one type of mouth work, speaking of someone that we have lost to another person, another type of mouth work is utilized in fantasy, one that is imaginary, equipped to deny the very existence of the entire problem. Born of a verdict of impracticable interjection, the fantasy of incorporation appears at once as its regressive substitute. Every incorporation has as its nostalgic vocation a failed attempt at interjection, a failed attempt to channel loss through the words in the mouth spoken to others. So I think that meditation on language and its relationship to orality and the fantasy of oral incorporation is a really valuable set of connections, very suggestive set of connections to make up, which are going to be developed a bit later in the essay, but also developed in Julia Christopher's work next week. So they're developing this opposition between melancholia, which is a refusal to mourn, and the fantasy of incorporation, okay, that fills a void by denying that there ever has been a loss, by swallowing a fantasy of the lost object and burying it in the psyche, in the form of the exquisite corpse. And I think we'll look at that process as both in theory and in Keats's poem, okay, in the seminars tomorrow. There is also another necro-melancholiac text that I meant to put on the syllabus. It's a 5 or 6 page short story. Some of you may know it. It's the most taught short story in the American literature.